I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm doing a solo live stream today, and for actually 5 weeks in a row. And the focus is going to be on Plato's dialogue, The Gorgias. Now, why am I doing this rather than talking about, say, the Titan submersible or the war in Ukraine or the coup in Russia and so forth? Well, there are a lot of people who are qualified to comment on these things. And I urge you to seek them out. I'm also qualified to comment on things like Plato's philosophy. And I thought I might as well put my PhD in philosophy to good use. And so what I'd like to do is begin a series of classes on great works in philosophy, great works in political philosophy. And I thought I would start with the Gorgias for this reason. Recently, I finished work on editing and putting together a new version of some old lectures I gave back in the 90s. It's my next book. It'll be out at the end of this month. It's called The Trial of Socrates. I'm really proud of this book. I thought these lectures were quite good. And I was constantly thinking, gosh, I don't remember knowing that. Or, oh, that's an interesting turn of phrase. And so what I did is once I finished the work on the trial of Socrates, I looked at another course that I did around the same time called What Socrates Knew. And this course focuses on two Platonic dialogues, the Alcibiades one and the Gorgias. And the Alcibiades one and the Gorgias were the first two dialogues in the Neoplatonic canon of introductory dialogues of Plato's. They were regarded as the best starting points for understanding Plato. And I agreed with that. I thought that was a very astute judgment. And so I did a course where we focused on Socrates' moral philosophy using these two dialogues. I think that the Gorgias is one of Plato's best dialogues. I think it's one of the best introductions to his canon. It was recognized as a great work even while Plato was alive. It was commented upon by his contemporaries, and it continued to be commented upon in the ancient world by the likes of Cicero, Epictetus, Aristides, Plutarch, Iamblichus, well into late antiquity. Also, Christian thinkers like Eusebius and Justin Martyr regarded it very highly. And of course, the Neoplatonists put it near the beginning of their introductory canon of Plato's writings. And there's a reason for that. They all saw something of great value here. So I thought, as a prelude to going through this other lecture course, What Socrates Knew, and revising it, I would reteach the Gorgias. And so that's my purpose here today and in the following 4 weeks. What are some of the themes of the Gorgias? Well, there are three main conversations in this dialogue. It's a long dialogue. In some editions, it's 100 pages long. It's a small book. There are three conversations. The first is a conversation between Socrates and the great sophist Gorgias. And the themes of that discussion are the relationship of rhetoric and philosophy, and also the relationship of wisdom to technique or art. The second conversation is between Socrates and Polus, who was another sophist. He was a student of Gorgias. And the main ideas that I think are important here are you can see the origin of the idea of what was later called positive liberty. And this is a tradition of thought that you find in modernity with thinkers like Rousseau and Hegel. Basically, they define liberty as doing what you really want to do, which is not necessarily what you think you want to do. And if what you think you want to do is inconsistent with what you really want to do, it is possible for the state, by preventing you from doing something that you think you want to do and forcing you to do what you really want to do, it's possible for the state to force you to be free, which is a very paradoxical sounding claim. This idea of positive liberty, I think, is first germinated in the conversation between Socrates and Polus. I think it's an extremely important idea in political philosophy, and I'd like to focus on that. And finally, there's a conversation between Socrates and Callicles. This is about power politics, really. It's about the relationship of might and right. And of course, that is an issue in political philosophy of perennial import, and it is discussed in our ideological circles to this day. So these are the main issues I take from the Gorgias. And the main theme of this class is going to be on the relationship of might and right. And this is brought forward in the very first sentence of the dialogue, actually. So before we go into the actual text, though, I want to just raise a question. What literary genre does the Gorgias belong to? If you've read it, you have opinions about it. And don't say it's a Platonic dialogue. That's too specific a genre. The literary genre, I think, that it most resembles to the untutored eye, to the naive listener, to somebody who's rummaging around in a bookstore and picks it up off the shelf and looks at it, they're going to think, oh, it's a play. You see the names of the characters and then a colon and then the things that they say after it. There's dialogue. There's drama. It's a play. It's a kind of play. And every play has certain dramatis personae, people in the play, the personas in the play. It has a certain time and a certain place. It has certain themes. And therefore, if we're going to read and understand this play, which is what Platonic dialogues are either plays or they're narratives, like novels and short stories. They either simply relate a conversation back and forth like a play does, or they will narrate conversations like a short story or a novel. So who are the various people in the Gorgias? Well, first of all, there's Socrates. Socrates was born 369 BC and died in 399 BC. He was an Athenian philosopher and man about town. We know quite a lot about his life and his ideas because he was a martyr for philosophy and one of the most well-known figures in really Western philosophical history. The ages of philosophy are denominated in terms of his name, just like we have years before Christ and Anno Domini, we have pre-Socratic and post-Socratic philosophy because Socrates was literally a pivotal figure in the history of philosophy. Gorgias was born around 485 BC and died 380 BC. He lived more than 105 years. He might have lived as long as 109 years. He was a sophist, meaning a teacher of rhetoric, who had a certain philosophical outlook. He was from Leontini, which is a Sicilian Greek city-state. Who are the sophists before we go any further? Well, sophistry was a school of thought that emerged in ancient Greece, and it emerged in the context of the beginnings of Greek philosophy and what we would now call natural science. Early on, philosophy and natural science were very closely related. They eventually separated. So you have early Greek philosophers who talk about the basic stuff of nature. This sounds more like what physicists do today. Then it was the work of philosophers to talk about these things. Greek natural philosophers basically looked to nature for the permanent, the unchanging, the structure of things. And they regarded anything that was ephemeral and transitory as contemptible, as something to be disregarded. They looked down upon it. One of the things that they looked down upon was culture, convention. Why? Because culture changes from time to time and place to place, whereas nature, in their view, was always the same. One important body of conventions govern human conduct. They're moral ideas. And the sophists came along and they thought, you know, conventions are contemptible. Nature is the only thing of real value. Therefore, most of the things that people guide their lives by, these ideas of what's noble and good or shameful and bad, this is just bunk. And it gets in the way of nature. And what does nature tell us to do? Well, nature tells us to be powerful. Nature tells us to be free. Nature tells us to satisfy our desires, our creature comforts. And so the sophists taught that you could get ahead and flourish by discarding conventions and embracing nature and using the power of speech to get your way. And so they were teachers of rhetoric and communication skills, basically, rhetoric and political theory. This was the world before mass communications, obviously, where people would get up in front of assemblies and speak. And this was the route to power. The Greek gentlemen looked down upon money making. They thought that the most honorable thing to do was to go into politics. And if you go into politics, the tongue is the most powerful weapon. They didn't talk about the pen versus the sword. It was more the tongue versus the sword. And if you are capable of speaking persuasively and you are divested of moral scruples that might get in the way of pursuing your interests, the sophists believe that you could become very successful in society. And so what they were is preachers of self-improvement, preachers of getting ahead in life, preachers of basically moral liberation, liberating your mind from morality, and using the technique of persuasion to become a powerful person in the political systems that they had in the various Greek city-states around the Mediterranean. The next character in the dialogue is Polus of Akragas, who was also from Sicily, a city-state in Sicily. He was a student of Gorgias and a fellow sophist. He was a historical figure. His works have been commented upon in the past, but they have been lost, unfortunately. Another important character is Callicles. Callicles is a well-born Athenian with a sophistical education and political aspirations. And Callicles is a fascinating character. He's only attested to in Plato's dialogues. Some people wonder if he's a fictional character. Others have said, no, that's unlikely. He might have been a real character. He might simply not be attested to in other historical sources for any number of reasons. Quite a lot of historical sources just haven't survived the end of the ancient world. Callicles is an advocate of shameless power politics, shameless immorality. He sounds like an early Nietzsche. And he's quite a fascinating character. He's a quite eloquent advocate for an amoral, power-hungry outlook on life. And finally, there's the character Chaerephon. Chaerephon was born 467 BC, died in 401 BC. He was one of Socrates' oldest friends. We know of him from several sources, from Platonic dialogues, from Aristophanes' comedy Clouds, and also his comedies Birds and Wasps. He's mentioned in Xenophon's Memorabilia, and he was known for his manic energy and his high squeaky voice, and people called him the Bat. And Chaerephon plays an important role here, and he plays an important role in Socrates' life as a whole. Chaerephon gets this conversation going. Chaerephon, according to Socrates, was the guy who got Socrates going on his philosophical quest. That's a just-so story. It's probably not true, but he did put it out there in his apology. He said the reason he became a philosopher is because his friend Chaerephon went to Delphi and asked the Pythia, the oracle, is there anybody wiser than Socrates? The oracle said no. Socrates said, I thought that was absurd. And so he decided to question people about philosophical ideas and became a philosopher. The story doesn't wash, of course, because Socrates already had a reputation for being a philosopher. And that's why when Chaerephon went to Delphi, he asked the question, is there anybody wiser than Socrates? Socrates already had a reputation for philosophy, so this couldn't have been the beginning of his quest. But anyway, Chaerephon plays a very important role in getting this conversation started. And I want to say a bit about the structure of the dialogue. There's an opening conversation, and then there are three longer conversations. And the longer conversations are with Gorgias, then Polus, then Callicles. And basically, they're structured in this way. Gorgias is a well-meaning guy. He is gentlemanly. He doesn't like to say shameful things. He's got a sense of shame. He wants to be a good man. He's also unphilosophical and he's somewhat conventional-minded, but he is the great teacher of rhetoric at the time. And so Socrates begins the conversation with him. Polus then takes over. And Polus takes over because Polus is willing to say shameful things that Gorgias is not. And we see that Polus is a rather shameless person, but he's also still fairly conventional in his values and aspirations. And therefore, he's not really philosophical. And then finally, we have Callicles. And Callicles talks for about 60% of the dialogue. And so the last three sessions of this class will be entirely about the conversation with Callicles. Callicles is utterly shameless, but he's not really conventional, and he's actually more philosophical than the other two characters. And Socrates has a real struggle with Callicles. Callicles is a very eloquent proponent of amoralism, and Socrates has to wrestle him into some kind of submission, and he uses Callicles' philosophical nature as his ally, basically, as an ally to bring him around. Now, what is the setting of this dialogue? Plato's dialogues are plays. Plays have settings. Plato's dialogues refer to historical characters. They also refer to historical events, and so most of them can be dated. For instance, the apology of Socrates to the jury, it was from 399 BC, just before Socrates was convicted and executed. The other dialogues that were set around that time can also be dated to 399 BC. Basically, all the dialogues have some internal clues that would allow you to date them, at least broadly, maybe not to the year, but you know, around a particular time, a certain decade, you might say. This dialogue is very difficult to date, however. It refers at one point to the death of Pericles as a recent event. Pericles died in 429 BC. It refers to Gorgias's visit to Athens, which was a historical event. That took place in 427 BC. Gorgias came to Athens in 427 BC. In 413 BC, Archelaus became king of Macedonia. His rise to the kingship of Macedonia is mentioned in the dialogue as a current event. So that would give us the date 413 BC or thereabouts. There's a play by Euripides mentioned. This play was premiered in 411 or 408 BC. And there was an event that took place in 406 BC that's mentioned as having taken place the previous year. So that gives us the date 405 BC. So we have anywhere between 429 and 405 BC as the date of this drama. Now, Plato obviously knew what was going on in his own lifetime. If classicists today can make notes of how strangely contradictory the setting is, surely this didn't escape Plato. Plato knew what he was doing. And so why is Plato setting this in a vast period of time? It's a long conversation, but it doesn't run from 429 BC to 406 or 405 BC. What's he doing here? The historical background of this period is the Peloponnesian War, which lasted from 430 BC to 404 BC. So it started a year before the earliest possible date of this dialogue and ended a year after the latest possible date of the dialogue. The setting of the dialogue is the whole period of the Peloponnesian War. I think that's significant. Also, the very first word of the dialogue is polemos, war. So that is a sense that the setting of this is war. One of the themes of the dialogue is power politics, which would include war. There are references to city walls, to martial arts, to military engineering. This is all part of the background. But what's going on here when a philosophical conversation seems to take place during the whole course of the Peloponnesian War? The war is happening in the background of the conversation, but somehow philosophy is outside of normal time. This philosophical conversation is taking place outside of normal time. It's not quite in eternity, but it's certainly outside of normal time. Another clue as to what's going on is this. Gorgias was the first theorist of what's called the kairos, the moment. The moment refers to the idea of timeliness, the timeliness of speech. And the sophists had a kind of metaphysics of timeliness. They believed that custom or opinion were king, that appearances and opinions, which are fleeting and changing, are king in society. And therefore, if you want to be powerful, you have to be able to manipulate customs and conventions. Even though you're free yourselves of believing in these things, if other people believe them, they can be manipulated. Opinions shift and change all the time. Events are constantly shifting and changing all the time. And the ability to persuade and the ability to exercise power, which is what the sophists were concerned about, depended on mastery of the moment, being timely. And therefore, you can say that rhetoric is a creature of time. And if philosophy is different from rhetoric, and there's a battle going on here, a polemos, between philosophy and rhetoric, philosophy is a creature of what? It's the untimely, eternity. There's a metaphysical distinction being drawn here between truth and opinion. Truth is permanent and objective. Opinion is always in flux. The sophists feel empowered to manipulate opinion because they think it's ultimately contemptible. It's not really true, but it's their way to power and enjoyment. Whereas truth is somehow untimely. It's objective, and therefore it's not indexed to opinion and to custom and to the changes of the world around us. Disraeli, the British Prime Minister, talked about how timeliness can annul truth. And timeliness can empower complete nonsense. It's just a fact about political persuasion and about opinion. Timely falsehood can change the course of a nation. And that's simply the truth. And so rhetoric is a creature of time. Philosophy is a creature of the untimely. And the whole dialogue's setting, its ambiguous setting, I think, is trying to draw this distinction. So let's talk a bit about what we know of Gorgias. Again, Gorgias was from Leontini, which is a Greek city-state in Sicily. He lived 105 years, maybe longer, maybe as long as 109 years. He was a wealthy gentleman, came from a good family. He was a trusted figure. He was trusted with being an ambassador from Leontini to Athens during the Peloponnesian War. So he's a political actor, but his greatest fame was as an orator, as a rhetorician. he would go around performing stunt speeches. They called them epideictic speeches, usually on topics from myth. A couple of these survive. One is his Encomium of Helen and Praise of Helen of Troy. The other is his Apology of Palamedes, who is a figure from the Iliad, the Odyssey, from Homer, who was executed by Odysseus. He published two books in his life. One was a collection of these stunt speeches, and the other was a treatise called On Non-Being. And according to reports about this treatise, he maintained in it that nothing exists, and if something did exist, it would be unknowable, and if it were knowable, it would be incommunicable. What's going on here? Well, basically, he's just pulling out all the guns, all the big guns he can, contradictory positions, but he is attacking the idea of an objective and permanent truth in favor of shifting opinions about particular things. The realm of change, the realm of opinion, the realm of rhetoric, where rhetoric can be king. So this is the metaphysics that he uses to ground his teaching about rhetoric and basically getting ahead in society. Apparently, Gorgias was also the inventor of the Q&A session, believe it or not. He was famed not only for standing up and giving these amazing rhetorical displays, but also he would challenge people to ask him any question. He invented the AMA, in other words. People would ask him anything, and he would come up with clever responses, and he wowed people with this. Now, Gorgias had a highly polished, ornate, sing-songy sort of style of writing. Aristotle condemned it as in poor taste. To that, I say I wish that Aristotle wrote even half as badly as Gorgias, because Aristotle would be much more readable if he had. Looking at the texts that have come down to us, well, classicists are better able to judge than I am. And so I want to read a little passage from a classicist named E.R. Dodds about the style of Gorgias's work. His art was, in fact, the art of verbal magic, what he himself called, quote, the incantatory power which by its witchery enchants, persuades, and changes the souls of men. This is from the Encomium to Helen. And the extant examples of his writing, the Encomium on Helen, the Palamedes, and a page from a funeral oration, are entirely consistent with such a view. They make the impression of a dazzling insincerity, an insincerity so innocently open as to be, except in the funeral oration, entirely void of offense. They are the work of an indefatigable stylist, a man who polished painfully every sentence that he wrote, caring passionately about its form, but very much less about its relationship to the truth. For him, fidelity to fact is a subsidiary matter. He knows that, quote, a speech delights and persuades a vast audience by the skillfulness of its composition, not by the accuracy of its statements, close quote. The style seems to us, as it did to later antiquity, affected and boring. The well-drilled words execute ad nauseum the same repetitive maneuvers with the mechanical precision of a platoon on a barrack square. But Gorgias's contemporaries were bewitched by it, perhaps just because it was so easily imitatable, a style which could be taught and learned. We can see for ourselves that men as diverse in their gifts and interests as Thucydides, Antiphon, and Isocrates, that's with an I, succumbed in varying degrees to the fascination. Plato did not. This is from Dodds's critical Greek edition of the Gorgias, which was published by Oxford University Press. He has a superb introduction. It's really quite well written and quite insightful, and he's very attentive to the dramatic quality of this dialogue. It's quite useful. So he was a great stylist, at least in his time, hugely influential. Maybe it seems a little sing-songy and mechanical to later ears. I want to share a couple of fragments that have come down to us from Gorgias. One reads, quote, "One must defeat the seriousness of one's opponents with laughter, and their laughter with seriousness." I think this is an indication of his belief in timeliness, right? If somebody is serious, you can laugh at them. And if they're laughing at you, you can turn right around and use seriousness against them. It seems contradictory in the abstract, but it works in the context. The other, I think, is a very profound statement. He says, "Tragedy produces a deception in which the one who deceives is more just than the one who does not." What's he saying here? He's saying that great tragic drama is a lie, right? It's a deception. It's not true. These things in Hamlet didn't actually happen. And yet Shakespeare is a better man for deceiving us than some guy who would never tell a lie and therefore never wrote a great play. And he goes on, he says, "And the one who is deceived is wiser than the one who is not." So if you're sitting in the audience and you are captivated by a great tragic drama like Hamlet, and you suspend disbelief, you will be caught up in it, you will enjoy it, and you will be made the wiser by it. But if you are not deceived, if you're just sitting there carping and criticizing it and just not getting into it, well, you're not deceived, but you're the worse off for it. It's very, very powerful. I think it's a very profound idea. Gorgias also erected at his own cost a statue of himself at Olympia in Greece. And there's an inscription that has come down to us. The statue is not, but the words have been preserved. "No mortal has yet found a finer art to train the soul for the contests of virtue." So he thought that he was, if not teaching virtue, at least giving people an art to deal with the contests of virtue, which I think is very interesting. What are the contests of virtue? Well, ultimately, I would say the contests of politics is what he's really talking about. So let's actually go into the text. Again, the main issue in the conversation of Socrates and Gorgias is a relationship of techne. The Greek word is techne, from which we get technique. It's translated here as craft. It's also translated as art. The relationship of art or technique to virtue and wisdom more broadly. So let's look at the opening exchange here. It's very peculiar. I have to say the opening words are somewhat baffling. Callicles in this translation, this is at 447 in the Greek, Stephanus numbers in the margin. "This, they say, is how you're supposed to do your part in a war or a battle, Socrates." Now, that's a somewhat windy paraphrase of a very, very condensed and tightly written piece of Greek. I don't pretend to be a classicist, but I can certainly see that he's adding a lot of words to it. There's a translation by Tom Griffith published at Cambridge that's a much tighter and more in tune with the Greek. Callicles says, I'm gonna mess with it a little. "You're in fine time, Socrates, for a war or battle, as the saying goes." And Socrates says, "Does that mean we're too late? Have we missed the feast, as they say?" So you can see Callicles is sort of poking fun at Socrates. He's saying, "You've arrived just in time for a battle. Namely, you've missed it." Right? Socrates thinks that the fine time to arrive at a battle is when it's over. "Oh, did we arrive when the feast was over, as the saying goes? Are we late?" And Callicles says, "Yes, it was a very urbane feast too. Gorgias gave us an admirable, very presentation just a short time ago." And Socrates responds, "But that's Chaerephon's fault, Callicles. He kept us loitering about in the marketplace." Now, this is a kind of strange comment because Socrates was always known to be at leisure in the marketplace. This was his way of life. And to describe it as loitering puts it in a somewhat negative cast, but he's making an excuse. Why is he blaming Chaerephon for basically doing what Socrates does all the time anyway? It's a kind of playful opening. And there's a lot of playfulness in this dialogue. And so what's happened is Gorgias has made one of his stunt speeches to a large crowd of people who have been gawking at him. And he's probably engaged in a Q&A. And Socrates has arrived too late for the speech, but in time for the Q&A. And this is important because one of the themes that you'll find in this opening discussion is the conflict, if you will, maybe we can just say the contrast, but he turns it into a conflict between giving speeches and engaging in dialogue, back and forth conversation. Socrates doesn't want to hear a big speech. He wants to have a conversation. And so in a way, he's come at the exact right time for his purposes because he doesn't want to hear Gorgias' speech, but he does want to have a conversation with Gorgias if Gorgias will let it happen. But it's interesting because what he does is he sends a boy to do a man's job, I guess you'd say. He sends his friend Chaerephon in, who's 2 years younger than him or so, his sort of junior partner in crime. They ran the thinkery together in the clouds. And he sends Chaerephon in to ask what kind of art Gorgias has, rather than just asking himself, which I think is interesting. Chaerephon says, "It's no problem, Socrates. I'll make up for it. Gorgias is a friend of mine, so he'll give us a presentation now, if you see fit, or some other time, if you like." What's this, Chaerephon? Is Socrates eager to hear Gorgias, says Callicles? And Chaerephon says, "Yes, that's the very thing we're here for." "Well then, come to my house anytime you like. Gorgias is staying with me and we'll give you a presentation there." And Socrates says, "Well, very good, Callicles, but would he be willing to have a discussion with us?" Not a presentation, a discussion. "I'd like to find out from the man what his craft, his art, his techne can accomplish, and what it is that he both makes claims about and teaches. As for the other thing, the presentation, let him put that on another time, as you suggest." And Callicles says, "There's nothing like asking him, Socrates. This was, in fact, one part of his presentation. Just now he invited those inside to ask him any question they liked. It was an AMA, and he said that he'd answer them all." "An excellent idea. Ask him, Chaerephon." "Ask him what?" "What he is." "What do you mean?" "Well, if he were a maker of shoes, he'd answer that he's a cobbler, wouldn't he? Or don't you see what I mean?" And Chaerephon says, "I do. I'll ask him. Tell me, Gorgias, is Callicles right in saying that you make claims about answering any question anyone might put to you?" "He is, Chaerephon. In fact, I just now made that very claim. And I say that no one has asked me anything new in many a year." This is Gorgias speaking. And he said, "I've heard it all." Well, he lived more than 100 years. So I guess he is not entirely boastful to make such a claim. "I have not heard anything new in many a year. So ask away." And then Chaerephon says, "In that case, I'm sure you'll answer this one quite easily. What is your art or what is your craft?" And Polus begins speaking for Gorgias here, just as Chaerephon is in a way speaking for Socrates. This is interesting. Something could be made out of it. Why are the epigones engaged in conversation here rather than the two main characters, Socrates and Gorgias? Why the hesitation just to get them into a conversation? What's Plato hinting at here? What's he communicating? Everything in these dialogues has to have some sort of meaning. So anyway, Gorgias says what he is a rhetorician, an orator in this translation. The Greek word is rhetorike. So he is an orator, he's a rhetorician. And this is at 449a. Gorgias says, "It's oratory, Socrates. So we're supposed to call you an orator." And Gorgias says, "Yes, and a good one, Socrates, if you really want to call me what I boast myself to be," as Homer puts it. Gorgias is kind of a boastful guy, but he has every right to be boastful. And so the Greeks wouldn't think there's anything wrong with this, because they would recognize that if you really are the best, there's no harm in saying so, especially if you're among your peers, basically. And Socrates says, "Aren't we to say that you're capable of making others orators too?" That's exactly the claim I make, not only here, but elsewhere. So what's going on here? He says he has an art, a techne, and that's oratory or rhetoric. And Socrates says, well, that means you have the ability to teach others as well. And he says, yes. One of the characteristics of a techne, of an art for the Greeks, is that it's teachable, which means that you understand it enough that you can articulate it and talk about it in such a way that you can teach people how to do it. Now, talking about it alone might not teach them how to do it. They've got to practice, right? But to have an art, you have to be able to have enough reflection that you can articulate it and you can teach it to others. And later on, we're going to find that art is contrasted with a knack in this translation. The Greek word is empyreia. Empyreia is the root for empirical. Basically, there's techne versus knack, art versus knack. An art has a logos attached to it. You have the ability to articulate what you're doing, whereas a knack is just something that you know purely through practice and that it doesn't come with any kind of articulate speech, any kind of articulate reflection on what you're doing that allows you to teach it, that allows you to talk about it, in other words, as you teach it to others. Now, people can still pick up knacks, right? They can just imitate or they can learn from practice as well. But to have an art is more than just having a knack. And teachability, meaning you can say something about it that's helpful in getting other people to pick up whatever body of knowledge you possess, whatever craft or technique you or art you possess. That is an essential characteristic of an art as opposed to mere fumbling. In English, in the 17th, 18th centuries, when people talked about empirics, what they meant were quack doctors who didn't have the art of doctoring. They might have had a few techniques that they picked up, a few knacks, but they didn't have an art. And so the sense of an empiric is a bumbler, is a person who has the ability to do certain things, but doesn't have a deeper understanding of what they're doing. And because they don't have a deeper understanding of what they're doing, they don't have the ability to pass it on to other people. And so Socrates says, well, now, Gorgias, would you be willing to complete the discussion in the way we're having it right now, that of alternately asking questions and answering them, and put aside for another time this long style of speech making like the one Paulus began with? Please don't go back on your promise, but be willing to give a brief answer to what you're asked. And Gorgias says, yeah, there are some answers, Socrates, that must be given by way of long speeches, but even so, I'll try to be brief as possible. This, too, in fact, is one of my claims. There's no one who can say the same things more briefly than I. Again, here he is bragging away. It might be justified. He is a gentleman. In a way, though, it's not gentlemanly to brag as much as he is. You know, the Greeks had this idea that if you're a superior person and you're surrounded by inferiors, you should hide your superiority a bit. The fact that he's willing to brag like this might indicate that he believes that he's among peers and that he knows that he can be completely frank about how he thinks himself to be, his self-image, knowing that it's not going to make any inferiors envious of him. I think that's probably an indication of what's going on here. He's being frank in this way because he thinks that he's in the presence of peers and he doesn't have to hide himself. Self-depreciation in front of inferiors is a term that the Greeks in Socrates' time called irony. And Socrates was famous for his irony. And Socratic irony means this kind of condescending dissimulation that you engage in front of people that you regard as inferior, hiding your superiority in front of people who might otherwise be basically envious of you. Okay, so anyway, they go off and they're going to have a real dialogue here, no oratory. And so Socrates asks, well, what is oratory about? What does it deal with? And he says, speeches. Well, what sort of speeches, Gorgias? Now, he could say all speeches. He could say that oratory, rhetoric, is a study of all speeches. You'd have to say, well, does that mean that it studies medicine and science? Is the orator going to study everything that's said by everybody? Is oratory, therefore, kind of like a universal encyclopedic knowledge? Because everything that's spoken about is what oratory studies. That would be extraordinary and it would be bizarre. And yet Gorgias wouldn't be trapped into saying that, because there's a distinction you can make between the content of speeches and the formal traits that they have in common. So you can study the discourse that takes place in, say, geometry and medicine and politics, and you can analyze its formal characteristics, and you can talk about logic, right? Demonstrative reasoning in the case of geometry, for instance. And you can talk about the formal characteristics of, say, political speech that is basically persuasion rather than demonstration. And if you want to see somebody in the ancient world who did that, you can look at Aristotle. Aristotle wrote books on basically logic, and he also wrote a book on rhetoric. And the book on rhetoric deals with the formal characteristics of persuasive speech. He doesn't talk about the things they talk about, he talks about the way they talk about them, modes of persuasion. But Gorgias doesn't say that. Gorgias doesn't say that oratory is about the formal characteristics of all persuasive speech, because he's not really interested in all forms of persuasive speech. He's interested in political speech. He's interested in speech that's connected ultimately to power. And so that's the direction that the conversation goes. And so Socrates says, okay, well, what is oratory concerned with? And Gorgias says, this is at 451d, he says, the greatest of human concerns, Socrates, and the best. And then Socrates says, well, wait a second here. Doctors say that the best thing in the world is health, and they help you recover your health. And physical trainers say the best thing in the world is fitness, and they help you become fit. Money managers say the best thing is to be rich, and they help you to become rich. How is oratory different from these things, right? He goes in somewhat nauseating detail through all these examples of other crafts, other arts. Why? Because he's trying to get Gorgias to differentiate his art, his techne, from the others and say what it essentially is. And finally, Gorgias comes out with what he thinks rhetoric essentially deals with. And this is at 452d. Socrates says, what is this thing that you claim is the greatest good for humankind, a thing you claim to be a producer of? And Gorgias says, the thing that is in actual fact the greatest good, Socrates. It is the source of freedom for humankind, and at the same time, for each person, the source of rule over others in one's own city. And what is this thing you're referring to? I'm referring to the ability to persuade by speeches judges in the law court, or in a law court, counselors in a council meeting, an assemblyman in an assembly, or in any other political gathering that might take place. In point of fact, with this ability, you'll have the doctor for your slave and the physical trainer too. And as for this financial expert of yours, he'll turn out to be making more money for somebody else instead of himself. For you, in fact, if you've got the ability to speak and to persuade the crowds. So Gorgias is basically saying that rhetoric deals not just with persuasion in general, at least the rhetoric that he's concerned with, doesn't deal with persuasion in general, doesn't deal with advertising jingles, right? It doesn't deal with children's literature. It deals with political persuasion, because that's the path to power. Political persuasion gives you the ability to be free yourself and to have power over others. And that's the greatest good for him. You can see the connection to power politics here. You can see the connection to the theme of war. He basically says that if you have the power of persuasive speech, you can make other people your slaves. It's not to put too fine a point on it. This is the art of pursuing power. The kind of person who's most analogous to Gorgias today, I guess, would be these people like Tony Robbins, right? Who talk about how to become more rich and powerful, in part using, you know, sort of mindset techniques and the power of the tongue. That's certainly the power that they're using to become rich and powerful. It's the power of persuasion. And so Socrates says, well, oratory is a producer of persuasion. You're instilling persuasion in the souls of your audience. And Gorgias says, yes, that's correct. And then basically he says, well, wait a second here. Other arts, other crafts persuade too. And he says, yes, but I'm not talking about persuading people about medical treatments or gym routines or whatever. I'm talking about, and he says this at 454b, the persuasion I mean, Socrates, is the kind that takes place in law courts and in those other large gatherings, as I was saying a moment ago, and it's concerned with those matters that are just and unjust. Now, at this point, Socrates' ears are pricking up like a dog, because Socrates is a philosopher, and one of the things that philosophy deals with preeminently is justice. And he's hearing this sophist saying that he's teaching the art of persuading people about justice. He sees Gorgias and Polus and Callicles as rivals, as philosophically opposed thinkers, and he's going to be doing battle now on this issue of rhetoric versus philosophy. So let's go into this. The first thing that Socrates does is he says, okay, there's a distinction that needs to be made. And the way he makes it, I think, is a little convoluted, maybe. Basically, he's just saying there's a distinction between knowledge and opinion. What's the distinction between knowledge and opinion? Well, you can say that it's my opinion that the coup in Russia is going to be an uphill battle, no matter who wins. And you can say, yeah, it's my opinion. I could be wrong about that. If I were to say something like Plato was one of the great philosophers, and I could be wrong about that, well, that would be to say that signal that I'm just inventing, you know, I'm putting forward an opinion. If I were to say that 2 + 2 = 4, but I could be wrong about that, that's sort of nonsense, because 2 + 2 = 4 is something that we know to be true. And you can't say that you know something to be true, you know something, and it's untrue, right? You can have an opinion that's untrue, but you can't have knowledge, genuine knowledge, that's untrue. If it's really knowledge, it's true. And so opinions can be untrue, knowledge is true. So he talks about true and false conviction. Yeah, that true and false opinions. You can have true and false opinions, but you can have true and false knowledge. Knowledge by its nature is true, or it's not knowledge. And so he basically asks Gorgias, okay, which kind of persuasion are you engaged in? Are you persuading people of opinions, or are you persuading people of knowledge? Are you persuading people of things that must be true, or are you persuading people of things that may be untrue? And Gorgias flat out says, well, look, I'm persuading people of things that are opinions. They result in beliefs, but they're not necessarily true. And this is interesting. And yet, and Socrates is puzzled by this, and he says, well, wait a second here. When Athens talked about building fortifications and military engineering and launching new warships, the people in the assembly spoke to experts, and the experts had expert knowledge. And that's really what statesmen should be listening to, right? They should be listening to experts who have actual knowledge. And Gorgias says, well, Socrates, I'll try to reveal to you clearly everything oratory can accomplish. This is at 455D. You yourself led the way nicely, for you know, don't you, that those dockyards and walls of the Athenians and the equipping of the harbor came about through the advice of Themistocles, and in some cases through that of Pericles, but not through that of the craftsmen, of the experts, of the people who knew. And Socrates says, that's what they say about Themistocles, Gorgias, that he persuaded people to do things that he had no actual knowledge of. I myself heard Pericles when he advised us on the middle wall based on something other than knowledge, basically. And Gorgias says, and whenever those craftsmen you were just now speaking of are appointed, Socrates, you see that the orators are the ones who give advice and whose views on these matters prevail. And Socrates says, yes, Gorgias, my amazement at that led me long ago to ask what it is that oratory can accomplish. For as I look at it, it seems to me to be something supernatural in scope. And Gorgias says, oh yes, Socrates, if only you knew all of it, that it encompasses and subordinates to itself just about everything that can be accomplished. And I'll give you ample proof. And then he talks about how the fact that he used to attend his brother, who was a well-known doctor, when he would see patients. And his brother would prescribe certain things like cauterizations or burnings or whatever that were unpleasant. And the brother knew what he was doing. And the patients were reluctant to do it. But then Gorgias would use his dazzling art of persuasion. And even though he didn't have knowledge of medicine, he would still be able to persuade the patients to follow the doctor's orders. And he says that this is a marvelous skill, and therefore, people are afraid of it, right? He's been driven out of cities because of his skill at teaching rhetoric. And he says, but this is unjust. Just because you have the skill doesn't mean that you should use it for ill gains. You shouldn't do anything wrong with it. If you learn how to box, that doesn't mean you should punch your father in the face, right? If you learn any art, any technique, you shouldn't misuse it. And when the pupils of, you know, say, boxers or rhetoricians misuse that, well, the teacher shouldn't be blamed. It's the fault of the student for misusing the art. And so here he's defending another trait of any technique, any art, as the Greeks understood it, namely that it's morally neutral. So for instance, the power of the pharmacist can be used to dispense cures or to kill. In fact, the poison is in the dose. There is a healing dose and a poisonous dose of almost every drug. And therefore, the techne of the pharmacist is morally neutral. It can produce opposite results, in other words, morally good or morally heinous results. The technique is neutral. It's innocent. It's the person who makes use of it who's at fault if they do bad things with it. And basically, Gorgias is saying, look, I'm just a technician here. He's like the scientists. They say, look, I just advise them on how to build nuclear weapons. I don't determine whether they drop them on cities full of people or not. I just experiment with viruses in a lab. I don't determine how these viruses may be used. We're innocent here. Our hands are clean. And this is one of the traits that Gorgias talks about earlier on of rhetoric, that the rhetorician's hands are clean. And he means that in the sense that it's a gentleman's art, that you don't have to lance boils or caulk barrels or anything like that. But there's another sense in which this is a clean-handed thing because it is a technique. The technician is innocent of the use to which it's put. That's on other people. That's on the people who misuse it. And this is an apology for his own work. This is basically his critique of the people who ran him out of town in Argos for corrupting the youth, which is, of course, something that Socrates later was put on trial for and executed for. So this is technique as the ancient Greeks understood it. Any art can produce opposed results. You can cure or kill with medicine or with drugs. And you have to, therefore, have something else that directs these arts towards a good end. And this is where philosophy comes in. And with this, I'm going to wrap up briefly, and then I'll take a brief break and we'll look at some questions. The Platonic definition of philosophy is the ability to make right use of all things. It has two traits: comprehensiveness, all things, and also morality, moral goodness, right use. So if you are a wise person, you can take whatever cards are dealt you by fate, by life, and you can make right use of them. You can play them well. And the reward for making right use of the advantages that life hands you, including technical skills that you might acquire along the way, the reward for making right use of them is well-being or happiness. Socrates argued that all men are pursuing well-being or happiness as they see it, and they believe that certain things are constitutive of happiness, like money, health, friends, and so forth. Good looks, right? These are things that people feel gifted by. These are gifts, gifts of nature, gifts of fortune. But they don't necessarily make you happy unless you use them rightly, which means that some people can be very, very fortunate in the things that they're given, yet they live miserable lives. Why? Because they use their gifts foolishly. They make bad choices. And it's also possible that some people who have very modest gifts or practically none at all, people who are born into very, very humble circumstances, if they're intelligent and wise in how they play their cards, they can still lead good lives. And so wisdom, as Plato understands it, and as Socrates understands it, is the ability to make right use, namely right for the purpose of living well, of all things. And that just basically means all things that you might encounter, but especially all things that fall within the sphere of your control. There are some things that you fall outside your control, and it doesn't matter how you use them. You can't use them. You can't affect them, right? The Stoics believe that there are some things we can change and some things that we can't. And that philosophy, moral philosophy, deals with the stuff that you can change, not the stuff that you can't. But the stuff that you can change, that varies from person to person. It varied from Epictetus, who was born a slave, to Marcus Aurelius, who became the emperor of Rome, right? Yet, they had very different options, very different cards dealt them, and yet they had the ability to play them well or badly, to use their fortune or misfortune well or not. And the reward for using it well is well-being. And so Socrates is very, very worried about technical skills because technical skills are being touted very highly as what we need for a good life, and especially the technical skill that the sophists put on sale, oratory, rhetoric, that is being put forward as the path to a good life for young gentlemen, the kind of people that Socrates was talking to, educating, trying to lead toward a philosophical life. And so he sees these sophists as corruptors of the youth, as potential corruptors of the youth. Callicles is one of these youths who's been corrupted by Gorgias. He thinks that the more powerful the technique, the more dangerous it is, right? If you are a druggist and you misuse your technique, well, you might overdose a couple of people, right? You might want to. You might be a very, very effective poisoner if you go really bad. But the harm that's done when, say, a cooper who makes barrels or a cobbler who makes shoes uses his technique, his art badly, is small potatoes compared to the harm that can be done when a person who attains power over an entire city can misuse his skills. And of course, Gorgias is selling the technique to gaining power. Again, he says, the purpose of oratory is to gain freedom for yourself and power over others. And the preeminent sort of image of the person who has freedom for himself and power over others is the tyrant. This is the art of tyranny. And therefore, this is a very dangerous art. It's far more dangerous than if somebody misuses the power of horse training or dog training, the art of cobbling or coopering, right? This is a very, very serious technique. And later, we find that, and I'll lay this out, that there are all kinds of interesting parallels between philosophical wisdom and the power that rhetoric has. Rhetoric, as practiced by Gorgias, for instance, is comprehensive, just like wisdom is comprehensive. Wisdom gives you the ability to dispose rightly of all things. What the sophists like Gorgias promise is that rhetoric will give you the power literally to dispose of all things. Again, everybody will be working for you if you end up running the city. So rhetoric is kind of the dark twin of philosophy. There's a certain resemblance to it, but it is entirely amoral. And because it's amoral and because it has such great potential destructive power, Socrates is very, very concerned to battle against it and put it in its place, and also to basically pull away the students who are being seduced by this, these youth who are being corrupted. Okay, so I want to take a break from this, and I just want to see if there's some questions here. I've been monologuing for more than an hour. At Entropy, Steve sends in $200 for the fundraiser. Thank you very much. Steve Friedrich sends in $10, says, no question yet, but great idea for a show. Best regards. Gadius writes in with $10. This sounds like the old battle between narrative versus truth. The sophists and demagogues are considered pejoratives today, so it seems like truth is valued higher. At the same time, persuasion clearly wins in the real world, especially in politics. Shouldn't we be siding with Gorgias here? Well, I think by now it's clear why we shouldn't be siding with Gorgias. Here's the thing. The world we live in today, like the ancient world, is a world where people are going around selling techniques, science and techniques for living well. And Socrates' great concern is that technique is not enough for living well. You have to have wisdom, which is something different from technical knowledge, and that has to supervene upon technical knowledge and direct it to a good end. So technique is never enough for living well. We live in an absolutely technique-besotted society. We live in a technological society. We live in a technocracy with technocrats running around, having their technocrat conferences. We have people who believe that we need to listen to the experts, right? And that we should shut up. We should shut up and listen to the experts. And yeah, we should listen to the experts who know certain things that we don't know. But that's not enough, right? Just as the experts on city walls and building triremes and military equipment were necessary, right? If you're going to be stocking an army or building fortifications, you listen to the experts. But ultimately, their knowledge can't apply itself. Knowledge is not self-applying. You can know an awful lot about building ships and yet not have the ability to make proper judgment about how many ships should be built, right? Technical knowledge doesn't satisfy these issues. You need some other kind of knowledge, some other kind of judgment. Now, in the past, we have the examples, right, of Themistocles and Pericles, who listened to what the experts said, but that made decisions. And what Gorgias is saying here is that, well, they made their decisions. They got their way because of the power of persuasion, of oratory. Maybe that's true. What's going on here is there's a decision that's being made, a decision to make use of technical knowledge. And that's what statesmen do. They make use of technical knowledge. Now, what if the statesmen think that there's a technical ability that they have to make use of other people's technical knowledge, right? That's what Gorgias is saying. Look, I'm giving these people the technical ability to make use of other people's technical knowledge, and that's the ability to persuade. You can still raise the question, okay, but yeah, are they making right use of that technical ability? So what you get is you get this dangerous situation where people who are empowered to decide and make, we hope, wise decisions, political leaders, really aren't trying to make wise decisions. The very idea of making a wise decision for them is foreign. What they believe that they're doing is just applying another kind of technical knowledge. But how do they apply that technical knowledge? They haven't even begun to think about the issue of right use. And so, you know, we have all kinds of technical skills, right? All the trades, the crafts, the trades. We've got these various professions. We've got scientists. We've got engineers. We've got people engaged in technical studies of things that have enormous implications for the world. And as we rise up in society and we have a wider and wider overview of all these different techniques and how they're integrated together and the direction things are going, people start wondering, is this all going in the right direction? How do we manage all this? How do we manage this technological society? And they say, I've got it. We'll have another technique. We'll have another technique. We'll teach technocrats at polytechnics the techniques of government. We'll teach them the techniques of persuasion. But then that just ignores that the real question here is not a question of technical skill, but the question of right use of technical skill. The whole realm of technique is in need of right use. It can't provide right use for itself. And yet we have this illusion that technology, that technical skill, the science, the experts with their knowledge is sufficient. And it's not. So this is the great problem that we face today. It's the same problem that was being dealt with by Socrates then. And no, we shouldn't be on the side of Gorgias. Gorgias is basically the guy who's shopping around the illusion that all the great decisions in society can be made through technique rather than through wisdom. And the essential difference between technique and wisdom, again, is that technique knows how to do things, but it doesn't know how to do them right or make right use of itself. Okay, so let's see if there's other questions here. Okay, Archie sends $7. Thank you very much. Many people claim that Western civilization wouldn't exist without Christianity. In a Big Think video, David Gelertner claims that Western civ was invented by Jews. Coincidentally, Ted Kaczynski sent him a bomb. Are Gelertner and Christians right, or is most of Western civ owed to Greco-Roman civilization? Well, obviously, a lot of Western civilization is owed to the Greeks and the Romans and other, you know, sort of folk traditions of the different European peoples. And the people who claim that it's somehow essentially connected with Christianity, Europe is the faith and the faith is Europe, that nonsense, they're engaged in Christian apologetics and they're overstating it. Europe existed before Christianity. Christianity is a phase that Europe is going through, right? There were Europeans before there was Christianity, and there will be Europeans after Christianity. In various post-Christian societies, there are a number of essentially post-Christian societies in Europe today, and they don't have any worse problems than the Christian societies of Europe today. So I'm not sympathetic to that. And of course, I understand why people like Gelertner are trying to argue that Jews are responsible for Western civilization. They're basically arguing that we should be listening to them more, as if we don't listen to them all the time already. Okay, so let's see if there are some more questions here. Archie writes in, today's lesson shows that Greeks taught morals, not just science and politics. Maybe the Christians got most of their morals from Greeks and Buddhists and very little from the Jews' Old Testament. Okay, did Christians get morals from the Greeks or from the Old Testament? I really would like to recommend a Jewish writer, actually, Simone Weil. Simone Weil was a Jewish sympathizer to Christianity and a student of the classics. Very strange woman. Starved herself to death in her 30s, but an absolutely brilliant commentator on philosophy. And she wrote a book called Intimations of Christianity Among the Ancient Greeks. And there's an essay in there called The Iliad or the Poem of Force. It's about Homer. And in there, just read that essay. It gives you a sense of what she's doing in the rest of the book. In there, she makes some astonishing claims that she also substantiates in the rest of the book. But basically, her view is this, that there's a Helleno-Christian tradition. She absolutely rejected the idea of a Judeo-Christian tradition. Christianity was a break from Judaism, and it was Hellenic. And she tries to show that essential moral concepts associated with the teachings of Jesus are found in places like Homer and the Greek tragedians and epic poets, and that they're alien to the Jewish mentality. It's a really interesting corrective to the people who have the sort of Robert E. Howard reading of Homer. And it is a very powerful argument. I think it's quite convincing. It's also interesting that she says that whenever people want to do evil, they always cite the Jews and the Romans as basically precedents for doing evil things. Whereas there's a Helleno-Christian tradition that represents a moral revolution against Judaism. So anyway, that's worth looking at, definitely. Okay, so let's go back into the text. I don't want to run over time. So after Gorgias says, look, I'm a technician. I'm not responsible for the use that's made of the technique that I teach. Socrates says, Gorgias, let's back up here and examine a distinction. He says that there's a distinction between two aims, two goals. One is the man who wants to win an argument, no matter what. That's his primary goal. And the other is the man who wants to get to the truth, and that's his primary goal. Now, these goals conflict. If you're wrong about something, you want to lose the argument because you want to get to the truth. If you want to get to the truth and you're wrong, you want to lose an argument. You don't want to win. But if you want to win an argument, even when you're wrong, chances are you're never going to get corrected. You're never going to be relieved of your errors. And the philosopher is the kind of guy who's more concerned with getting to the truth than winning an argument. In fact, the philosopher is the kind of guy who graciously will thank you for teaching him a lesson when you beat him in an argument. And he's just trying to get Gorgias on board, on the record about what kind of guy that he is. This is foreshadowing because Socrates is going to beat Gorgias down, right? And so he wants to basically get him on record that he would welcome this if it brought him closer to the truth. And Gorgias says, yes, I'm the sort of person you describe. But then he says, and this is interesting, because the question is, you know, do you want to continue the conversation, right? What kind of man are you? Because what kind of man you are will affect whether or not we continue this conversation. And Gorgias says, look, I'm the kind of guy who wants to get to the truth. However, we might not want to continue the conversation. He says this at 458b. He says, oh yes, Socrates, I say that I myself too am the sort of person you describe. You want the truth and you're willing to lose an argument gracefully if it gets you there. Still, perhaps we should keep in mind the people who are present here too. For quite a while now, even before you came, I gave them a long presentation, and perhaps we'll stretch things out too long if we continue the discussion. We should think about them too, so as not to keep any of them who want to keep any of them who want to do something else. Now, you could say that maybe he's trying to weasel out here, but I just think this is Gorgias being the consummate gentleman. He's concerned about the audience. It's like, yeah, okay, I will continue this on the trail of truth as far as we need to go, but these people have been standing around a long time. What about them? And Chaerephon says, you yourselves hear the commotion these men are making, Gorgias and Socrates. They want to hear anything you have to say. And as for myself, I hope I'll never be so busy that I'd forego discussions such as this conducted in the way this one is, because I find it more practical to do something else. Imagine him saying that in a manic way with a high squeaky voice, and that would be Chaerephon. And so Callicles chimes in and says, yes, let's keep going. And so Socrates says, okay, well, Gorgias, do you say that you're able to make an orator out of anyone who wants to study with you? Gorgias says, yes. And Socrates continues, so that it'll be persuasive in a gathering about all subjects, not by teaching, but by persuading. Yes, that's right. Teaching means imparting knowledge. Persuading means imparting opinion, which can be false. Socrates says, you were saying just now, mind you, that the orator will be more persuasive even about health than a doctor is. And Gorgias says, yes, I was more persuasive in a gathering anyhow, which I think is quite hilarious. And Socrates hones right in. He says, and doesn't in a gathering just mean among those who don't have knowledge? The orator will be more persuasive about health among people who know nothing about health, but he won't be more persuasive at, say, a medical convention. That's what he's saying. And Gorgias says, yes, that's true. And Socrates says, now, if he'll be more persuasive than a doctor, doesn't he prove to be more persuasive than the one who has knowledge? And he says, yes, that's right. That's the thing that's so almost supernatural about rhetoric, right? You can be more persuasive without knowledge than the expert who has knowledge if you possess this art. And Socrates goes on a little further. He says, so when an orator is more persuasive than a doctor, a non-knower will be more persuasive than a knower among non-knowers. Isn't this exactly what follows? He's saying, so a person who doesn't know can be more persuasive than a person who does know in front of an audience of ignoramuses. And Gorgias agrees with that. He says, yes, this is true. And Socrates goes on, he says, the same is true about the orator and oratory relative to other crafts too, then. And here he's trying to tie poor Gorgias in a knot. He says, oratory doesn't need to have any knowledge of the state of their subject matters. It only needs to have discovered some device to produce persuasion in order to make itself appear to those who don't have knowledge that it knows more than those who actually do have it. And this is true. And then Socrates asks an important question here. Whether the orator does or does not come off worse than the others because of this being so, we'll examine in a moment. For now, let's consider this point first. Is it the case that the orator is in the same position with respect to what's just and unjust, what's shameful and admirable, what's good and bad, as he is about what's healthy and about the subjects of other crafts? Does he lack knowledge, that is, of what these are, of what is good and what is bad, or what is admirable or what is shameful or just or unjust? Remember that that's one of the things that Gorgias says oratory deals with, the just and the unjust, the most important things in life. Examples he gives are justice and injustice. And of course, that's the way that you talk when you are talking about politics, when you're before law courts and assemblies and councils dealing with matters of state. You talk about the just and the unjust. And so basically what Socrates is saying here is, look, if it's true that orators can persuade the ignorant about medicine, even if the orators are ignorant of medicine themselves, does it also mean that orators can persuade people about justice and injustice, even though they're ignorant of justice and injustice themselves? And Gorgias doesn't like this. He's a well-meaning guy. He goes on, I'm going to just condense this a bit, but basically what happens is this. Gorgias says, well, if somebody doesn't know what justice or injustice is before they come to me and study oratory, I'll teach them that along the way. But he wants to say that orators will know what justice or injustice is. They don't need to know about medicine. They don't need to know about shoemaking. They don't need to know about any of the other arts in order to be persuasive about it. But he does say that they will know about justice and injustice. Either they'll know about it beforehand, or he'll teach it to them along with the art. But no matter what happens, the orator is going to know about justice and injustice. And Socrates says, hold it there. You're right to say so. If you make someone an orator, it's necessary for him to know what's just and what's unjust, either beforehand or by learning it from you afterwards. And Gorgias says, yes, it is. And he says, well, you know, if a man who learns carpentry becomes a carpenter, wouldn't a man who learns justice be a just man? That would follow. And if orators all know what justice is, doesn't that mean that all orators are just men? That would follow too. And Socrates says, therefore, an orator will never want to do what's unjust. This is interesting. Socrates has this premise that he argues for elsewhere, that if you know what's good, you'll do it. So virtue is a kind of knowledge. If you know what justice is, you will do just things. Gorgias has now said that orators either know what justice is before they learn oratory, or they'll know it after they learn oratory from him. But in any case, they'll know what oratory is. Orators, therefore, are just men. Just men do just things, according to Socrates. And then Socrates says, well, I've caught you in a contradiction here, Gorgias. What's the contradiction? Gorgias is now maintaining that everybody who is an orator does just things. If they know the art of oratory, they will do just things. So it's not a morally neutral technique like he said it was earlier when he was arguing, look, I just teach them to build the bombs. I just teach them to give the arguments. I'm not responsible for what they do with them. That's up to the individual students. And it's possible for individual students to misuse the art of oratory. But now he's saying that every orator knows what's just. And if knowing what's just is to do the just, then it doesn't seem possible for an orator to misuse the art of oratory. Do you see the point? Do you see the contradiction there? Socrates sums it up around 461a. He says, okay, well, at the time you said that, I took it that oratory would never be an unjust thing, since it always makes its speeches about justice. But when a little later you were saying that the orator could also use oratory unjustly, I was surprised and thought that your statements weren't consistent, and so I made that speech in which I said that if you, like me, think that being refuted is a profitable thing, then it would be worthwhile to continue the discussion, but if you don't, to let it drop. But now, as we subsequently examine the question, you see for yourself, too, that it's agreed that, quite to the contrary, the orator is incapable of using oratory unjustly and of being willing to do what's unjust. By the dog, Gorgias, it'll take more than a short session to go through an adequate examination of how these matters stand. And that's the end of the discussion between Socrates and Gorgias. Socrates has caught Gorgias in a contradiction. And we see the beginning of the conversation with Polus after this. And Polus pipes up and he says, really, Socrates? Is what you're now saying about oratory what you actually think of it? Or do you really think, just because Gorgias was too ashamed not to concede your further claim that the orator also knows what's just, what's admirable, and what's good, and that if he came to him without already having this knowledge to begin with, he said that he would teach him himself. And then from this admission, maybe some inconsistency crept into his statements. Just the thing that gives you delight, you're the one who leads him on to face such questions. Who do you think would deny that he himself knows what's just and would teach others? To lead your arguments to such an outcome is a sign of great rudeness. He's saying it's bad taste here to do this. He's saying, look, we're all men of the world here. And we all know that occasionally we've been, you know, this is something that Bill Buckley said once. It was just this utterly cynical thing. He said, it's just bad taste to ask Bill Clinton about cheating on his wife with Monica Lewinsky. Why is it bad taste? Because we're all men of the world here, and we know that everybody cheats on his wife. It's like getting up and saying, have you ever been drunk? As if, you know, we all hadn't been drunk from time to time. And so what he's doing here is he's saying, look, this is bad taste because Polus here, or because Gorgias here, is just too ashamed to admit, to say anything shameful about rhetoric. Yet we all know that the reason why people are studying with the sophists is because they want to get rich quick. They want to cut corners. They don't want to follow what's moral all the time. They want freedom for themselves and power over others. And they know that injustice is the way to do it. Talk about justice, but do injustice. But you basically got Gorgias here tongue-tied because he's too ashamed to admit what's really going on, whereas I am not ashamed. And so at this point, Polus takes over the argument. And so we'll read the conversation with Polus next time. But anyway, that's the transition. I do want to just say a few interesting things here about the rivalry of rhetoric, and philosophy. There's a point where Gorgias basically says that rhetoric is the controlling art. It's the art that can control all the other arts because it can control the city, and the city basically can regulate the activity of all the artisans within the city. And there's a term that is used for that. It's called the architectonic art. It's the art that directs all the other arts. It's the supreme art. So it's the highest art. It's the comprehensive art. It's the art that controls all the other arts. The problem with that, though, is that as an art, it still needs something else above it to ensure that it directs itself and all the other arts to good ends, and that's namely wisdom. And wisdom isn't an art. You know, arts need wisdom. Wisdom can't therefore be an art. Philosophy ensures that everything is well used to produce well-being. And so the architectonic art, though, seems to be like philosophy. Again, it's rules over all things. It's comprehensive. It also claims that it makes the other arts effective. And this is part of Gorgias' speech. He says that I can make doctors more effective as doctors by persuading their patients to listen to them. Right. So he's saying that it has the power to regulate other arts and make them more effective. Well, that's similar to the claim that philosophy puts forward, that it allows us to take arts, techniques, gifts of fortune, and make them effective for well-being. It puts them to work for well-being. Rhetoric puts these arts to work as well, but it sort of leaves out the moral dimension. It makes things more effective, but it doesn't necessarily make them more moral. Both philosophy, as Plato understands it, and rhetoric are very practical. They're all about practice. They're all about getting things done, about changing the world. But again, just because you can do things, just because you can change things, doesn't mean you ought to change things. Just because you can make certain changes doesn't mean that you're making changes that are actually conducive to human well-being. And your art can't tell you that. That has to come from on high. It has to come from above. It has to come from wisdom, which is a different kind of knowing. It's not expertise. It's not art. It's something else. There's also the claim that rhetoric deals with the highest good, right? The well-being. And the way Gorgias defines well-being is freedom for oneself and power over others. But he does say it's the highest good. He does say it's connected with the just and the unjust. It sounds very highfalutin. But again, it's a highest good that is stripped of any essential moral dimension. Freedom for yourself and power over others isn't necessarily a good thing. One way that you can understand this is that you can always say, okay, I have freedom, but do I have too much freedom? Can you have too much freedom? Yeah. There are a lot of people who are miserable because they're free. They've got too much freedom. Can you have too much power? Oh yeah, you can have too much power. There are a lot of people who are made miserable by having too much power. Well, if you can have too much freedom or too much power, then what that says is that you need some other faculty to help you decide what's enough, to draw the line. And that would be moral discrimination. And that's what wisdom provides. So wisdom would tell you, this is where you've got too much freedom. Beyond this point, it's going to make you worse off than better. This is the point where you've got too much money or too much power or too much of anything. If you can have too much of something, then it's not always good, right? This is the easiest way to defeat the diversity argument, by the way. There are all these people who go around and say, oh, diversity is wonderful. It's our greatest strength. And you can say, well, you know, can you be too rich for your own good? And they'll say, oh, yes, you can be too rich for your own good. Is it possible to actually be too good looking for your own good? And people can say, oh, yes, you can be too good looking for your own good. And on and on and on. And finally, you say, well, isn't it possible that you can have too much diversity? Aren't there circumstances where, you know, if money can go from being a good thing to a bad thing, and beauty can go from being a good thing to a bad thing, and freedom can go from being good to bad, and power can go from being good to bad, doesn't it stand to reason that diversity can cross the line, that you can have too much of it? And of course, don't want to confront that possibility. You can say, okay, I grant you diversity is a wonderful thing. Can there be too much of it? You see, what's going on is our civilization is being egged on to suicide, to destruction, basically by people who have erected a false moral absolute. We can never have too much diversity. We can never have too many immigrants. We can never have too many kebab shops. And the answer to that is, well, obviously, we can have too much. There can be too much of a good thing. Too much water will drown you, even though you need it to survive, right? There could be too much of any good thing. I know it's granting them too much maybe to say that diversity is a good thing, but if you want to just do this dialectically, say, okay, I'll grant that diversity is a good thing. When do we have enough of it? Could we have gotten too much of it? How do you tell? Once you get people thinking about it, the whole game is up, because the whole thing works by basically creating a fake moral absolute that people just sort of dance themselves to death around as they worship it. And they never take a step back, and they never say, maybe there's too much. Maybe there's too much fentanyl, right? Maybe there are too many immigrants. Maybe we've got too much freedom. That's the way to basically blow up all these crazed political cults that are driving our civilization into the abyss. There's only one thing you can never have too much of, and that's wisdom. That's the Platonic teaching. There's only one thing that's unconditionally good that you can never have too much of, and that's wisdom. Everything else you can have too much of. And therefore, it needs to have lines drawn. It needs to be regulated. It needs wisdom to come down from above and direct it. And this is why there's this idea in the Republic of the best society is a society where philosophers are kings, right? What you want is you want wisdom incarnate ruling over all of society rather than technique ruling over all of society. That's how you gain a good society, is you have wise rule rather than simply technique run amok without even an awareness that it's not enough. And that's the world that we live in today. So that's basically what I want to say about this conversation with Gorgias. I think we have to give Gorgias some credit here. He is a well-meaning guy. He wants to do the right thing. He's a person with a sense of shame, but he's not a philosopher. He is easily defeated by Socrates. And we see that you've got basically this case of a well-meaning guy who's going around and handing out the parts for, metaphorically speaking, the atomic bomb. And saying, I'm not responsible for what happens, even though he's drawing people to him by promising them freedom and power over others. There's something kind of goofy and irresponsible about this guy, even though he's well-meaning. He's a dangerous individual. He's a dangerous figure. And he's especially dangerous because he was by all accounts somebody that people admired. They would look at Gorgias and they say, there's an admirable guy. There's a guy that we can trust as an ambassador. There's somebody who's obviously extremely intelligent, very eloquent, well-meaning in his own way, but dangerous because this well-meaning, creditable fool is going around teaching this fake and dangerous simulacrum of the wisdom that we all need to lead good lives and have well-ordered societies. Okay, I'm going to wrap up, and I just want to remind you all that next week what we're going to do is read the conversation with Polus, which is 461b to 481b. And the issues that we will see there, that they'll just jump out at us, right, are the idea of positive freedom, which is a powerful critique of liberalism. It was a critique of liberalism before the term was ever coined. And also a very interesting idea of penology, of punishment. And a lot of very, very fundamental ideas about well-being. And the distinction between, again, well-being and what the sophists were seeking, which is freedom for oneself and power over others, which becomes very clear in the hands of Polus, is just identical with being a tyrant. So thank you so much. I hope this worked. I hope this was good. I'm going to do it for 4 more weeks, and we'll learn a lot about the Gorgias. And I think we'll learn why this has been such a classic for ever since it was first published, because it's filled with extremely powerful ideas. And if you get through the Gorgias, you'll be in a very good position to read any of the other Platonic dialogues, even the big ones. The biggest, of course, being the biggest in the sense of thick, but also difficult and rich, is the Republic. So thank you very much.